In our minds, the Italian Renaissance was a most civilized age, with its stunning art and architecture, its literature, and its delightful music. But just beneath that elegant veneer was a culture of political scheming and violence that could be truly shocking, even by today's standards. Occasionally, the turmoil burst into public view, as happened in Florence in April 1478. The day began with daggers drawn during Mass in Florence's magnificent cathedral, and ended with corpses, including that of an archbishop, dangling from the government palace. With us today to discuss this astonishing episode in Renaissance politics is Dr. Lauro Martinez, former professor of European history at UCLA. Dr. Martinez is the author of numerous acclaimed works on Italian Renaissance history, including the recent April Blood, Florence, and the Plot Against the Medici. Welcome, Dr. Martinez.
Hello. Hello, I'm here. I'm very pleased to be on your program.
Oh, well, thank you. How would you describe the political climate of 15th century Italy?
Well, I would say that we have to think of or remember that government is in the hands of princes, leading noblemen, and merchant elites, and that these gentlemen are all operating in the 15th century in a setting, I would say, of nervous, uneasy alliances because of the play of acquisitive ambitions. And in the middle of it all, that is in central Italy, around Rome and north and across to the Adriatic, the papal state, one can say, is probably the most unstable of the five great states. And because popes change, as they do often enough, then that kind of instability continues, and they kind of offer trouble for their neighboring, for the neighboring states, Florence, Venice, and so on.
In Florence, when one thinks of 15th century Italy, one thinks of the Medici, and who were they?
Well, they were, in the 15th century, they are without any doubt the richest family in the city. They are bankers. After the year 1434, they also become the veiled or behind-the-scenes bosses in the city. These are people who rule by bending, or if you prefer, corrupting the electoral procedures of the old republic. They use bribery, they bully, and they manipulate men in offices from behind the scenes.
Were they an old family?
They were, yes, they went. They were a family who went back, who were first to the 13th century. We first hear of them then, but they don't really come into their own politically until the early 15th century, although they are there. They're in politics, they're in office in the 14th century, but they have a reputation for violence, and that doesn't really go away until sometime in the early 15th century.
On the other side of the story were the Pazzi, and who were they, and why did they hate the Medici so much?
Well, just very quickly, the Pazzi are really a much older lineage, because their origins go back to old feudal nobility. But in the early 15th century, they become bankers, and soon they become the second richest family in the city of Florence, and so almost by definition, they become rivals to the Medici. However, they marry into the Medici. One of the daughters of the Pazzi family marries into the Medici in 1459, by arrangement, obviously, of the elders. So the two families are making an attempt to get on very well together. But the Pazzi can never have the sort of political networks nor the top places in government that the Medici have and control, and they will come to resent this.
One of the principal players in this story is Lorenzo de' Medici. How did he become, as you call him, boss of the shop upon the death of his father? I mean, he had a brother. Why didn't they share power?
Yes, he has a glamorous younger brother who might have shared power with him, but it wasn't so much a question of primogeniture, although Lorenzo is the older of the two. It's not quite so much that as a matter of the fact that Lorenzo in the last analysis, is really supremely talented politically, much more than his brother, and therefore he naturally takes over. Quite apart from the fact that he's older, he has cunning, he has a keen sense of timing, he's enormously charming, but he also knows how to use the old stick and carrot technique brilliantly.
How did he operate politically in his first years in power?
Well, in the early years, he cooperated with the earlier Medician henchmen who were really the friends of his father, Piero, and especially of his grandfather, the great banker, Cosimo. He goes along with them in the early years, and then very gradually he begins to break loose from them and bring in his own younger men.
At the beginning of our conversation, you mentioned the Papal States, and of course that involves the Pope at the time, Pope Sixtus IV. What was Lorenzo's relationship with him?
Well, the relation there was very simply this, that the Medici had been the papal bankers since, the 1440s, even before the 1440s, but popes tended to change their bankers. Only Medici were always there. So in the early 1470s, when Pope Sixtus IV becomes Pope, Lorenzo and the people in Lorenzo's bank are this Pope's bankers. But at a certain point in the middle of the 1470s, the Pope wants to borrow a large sum of money in order to buy the town of Imola, and Lorenzo refuses to give him the loan because he himself and Florence have interests in the eastern part of Tuscany, which borders on this town and on the Papal State. And this refusal turns Pope Sixtus against the Medici, and very soon thereafter he hires the Pazzi as his principal bankers. So now the two great families of Florence really are primary rivals.
Why does this loan pit them against each other? Why would Lorenzo care that the Pazzi lent the Pope money?
Well, precisely because Lorenzo and Florence also had ambitions in that part of Italy. And so we can't say that here were two interests that came into direct conflict in foreign policy terms.
That, I thought, was an intriguing point, because Lorenzo is refuses to lend the Pope money out of his own money, not the city's money. Am I correct?
No, that's true. You are right.
Let's move to 1478 and that fateful day. How did the conspiracy unfold, in terms of plotting and such?
Well, I would say that it begins in Rome about 7 or 8 months before that, in the late summer, autumn of 1478. The chief Pazzi banker in Rome, Francesco, has friends in high place at the court in the Roman Curia, and at a certain point, he gets the go-ahead from the Pope to begin kind of plotting against the Medici. Francesco de Pazzi also has as his companion in the plot, of course, a Florentine by the name of Francesco Salviati, who happens also to be the Archbishop of Pisa, who bitterly resents the Medici because they got in the way for a long time of his appointment to that post. Lorenzo did. And so here you've got these two men, the banker and the Archbishop, working with the sort of secret support of the papacy, suddenly, to try to bring Lorenzo down, to try to overthrow him, so that the papacy will at that point be able to conduct its own policies in central Italy more easily without the Medici getting in his way. And now also the Pazzi will have a freer hand in Florence to hold key office time and again, and to develop their own networks of friends and clients.
How difficult did it appear to be to get to Lorenzo and Giuliano?
Well, it would have been extremely difficult, except that the plotters, obviously, with the secret support of the Pope behind them, and then a little later also the support of the King of Naples, they feel very bucked up about this. This gives them the courage to go through with it. But from about late 1477, early 1488 on, the two brothers are less and less often seen together in public, which is why in the weeks leading up to the assassination attempt at the end of April 1478, the plotters have a lot of difficulty getting the two brothers together, because they've decided that they must be killed at one and the same time. And in the end, it can be said, this is why they are compelled to strike in the cathedral at High Mass, because here, finally, they have the two together, at least in the same venue. And also, by this time, so many people know about the plot, and the soldiers who have been hired in support of the plot are approaching the walls of Florence, that the plotters, the conspirators, at this point, have no choice but to strike in the cathedral itself.
Can you describe for us the scene in the cathedral and in the streets of Florence that afternoon?
Well, first of all, the banker, Francesco dei Pazzi, either he or his companion, another lesser banker, Baroncelli, make the first strike. They lunge at the younger brother, Giuliano, and kill him on the spot, and then they go, along with two priests, after Lorenzo himself. But at that moment, also, pandemonium breaks out in the cathedral, and people rush out in terror. And the result of that is that all the plotters in the cathedral, in the confusion, are also able to get away, to rush out. That's what happens in the cathedral.
And what happened to Lorenzo?
Lorenzo, of course, is slightly wounded and gets away by concealing himself in one of the two sacristies, along with several of his friends, including apparently even his mother, the great humanist Poliziano, who afterward was to write a famous commentary on the plot. And there they remain behind locked doors in the north sacristy for perhaps an hour, and everything is silent outside, but they're afraid to come out because they're afraid that the conspirators may be on the other side of the great bronze doors waiting for them. Instead, the conspirators have already fled, and after about an hour or so, they are able to come out because friends come and collect them, friends who are fully armed. And meanwhile, however, the Archbishop of Pisa, another plotter, as I've said, has made his way to the government palace to try to take it over in order to overthrow the government.
So Lorenzo has been wounded, Giuliano was dead. How did the Florentine government respond to all of this?
Well, the moment the plot has been foiled inside the government palace, the members of government are soon enough able to get hold of the conspirators whom they have trapped inside. Those conspirators are either killed on the spot or wounded and then thrown through windows. Some are hanged from the windows. And the attempt on the outside by another member of the conspiracy, the older Pazzi involved, Jacopo dei Pazzi, fails. He fails to rally the people behind their attempted coup d'etat, and he then is finally forced to flee from the city. And after about, perhaps 3 or 4 hours altogether, that is by about 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon, it's clear that the conspirators have been totally defeated, and now the government steps in with its wave of killings, of executions. This is the first wave of vengeance that passes through the city.
That's the first wave, but how long did Lorenzo's men continue to hunt down the conspirators?
Most of the alleged conspirators, including lots of innocents, are really killed within the next few days, the next week or so at the most. But one of the chief ones who got away, who ended up in Constantinople, is then brought back. This is Bandino Piero Baroncelli. He is brought back about a year later, brought back right to Florence and executed in Florence. But most of the executions take place within the first 5 or 6 days.
Did this attempt upon Lorenzo's life have any impact upon the running of Florence in terms of politics?
Absolutely, because once the plot has been foiled and the so-called Pazzi War, which follows quickly thereafter, comes to an end after he made a dramatic trip down to Naples to talk to the king there, he comes back and is now fully in control in the city. And by using the circle of friends around him, he's able to impose stricter controls on the city of Florence. And for the first time, we get the famous Council of 70, which is a kind of senatorial oligarchical body of 70 men, every one of them being his sort of friends and cronies. And down to the time of his death in 1492, therefore, he is much more fully in control of everything that goes on in the city. Questions of war and peace, diplomacy, policies with regard to taxation and so on.
We only have a moment remaining, but the 1478 conspiracy is just a very interesting tale unto itself. But does it have any relevance to today?
Well, yes, I would say perhaps too quickly. First of all, whenever licit or legal political ambitions are really choked or frustrated, there we may have political ambitions may issue an explosive violence, particularly if before that you've had some degree of what we might call state terrorism. And in the case of the Medici, this involved the use of exile, of imprisonment, of confiscatory taxation, of using the tactics of intimidation, of denying people office, and really of two coup d'etats, one in 1458 and one in 1466. The other thing is that the Medici regime, like others in that period, very often use religion in street processions and for special masses and religious services. And insofar, therefore, as any regime or terrorist, let's say, tries to justify its dominance by making an appeal to God, it strikes me that this will almost certainly render the political game much more dangerous, because men who kill for God kill, it seems to me, with a better conscience and therefore much more easily. Perhaps this does have relevance for our time. You tell me.
I think it does. Well, thank you, Dr. Martinez.
Thank you very much for having me on your program.
Okay, we have been talking with Dr. Laura Martinez, author of April Blood, Florence and the Plot Against the Medici.